You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Welcome to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On. Today, I have a special guest, Xander Keeg. He is a social worker and a trans man, and he has an incredible background. And Xander, I'm going to have you share that with our audience today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. On. It's wonderful to be able to be here with you today. Well, you know, you covered some of what would be more the big points, right? I'm a trans man. I'm a social worker. I live in Florida. I'm married. I served in the U.S. Coast Guard. I was born and raised in California in Los Angeles County. I spent most of my life in the Southwest. So I spent most of my time in California, Colorado, Utah, and Arizona. So I'm new to the Southeast and the East Coast in general. Until very recently, I was involved with WPATH, which is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. I was engaged as one of their faculty members for their Global Education Institute, something that I really enjoy doing. You know, lots of things going on in my life right now, so I've made a pivot to, you know, to other things, but I did enjoy it for a number of years. And I've also been able to do some other teaching and mentoring or consulting for students who are wanting to become certified to work with LGBT clients in their psychotherapy practices. And so I'm still doing some of that work, but not as much these days.
I like the way you introduced yourself. Yeah, those identities, right? They are important because I think people tend to latch onto a label and then they forget that there are other pieces to a human being.
Yes. I mean, I didn't mention, you know, sometimes I do. I didn't mention that I'm first generation American. My family's from Mexico. I do sometimes mention that, but I like to mention that I'm married, specifically in the trans context, because so many people believe that our relationships don't, quote, survive or last through the transition. And I like to be able to say my wife and I were 3 years into our dating relationship when I started my transition. And we've now been together over 20 years. So I started my transition about 17 years ago, 17 and a half years ago. So it is possible. And I know many, many trans people who are still married to the spouse that they were with before they started their transition. And it's definitely possible. So I like people to be able to know that.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I was talking with Dr. Christy Overstreet, who you know, and I mentioned some of the hardships that people experience when a partner does transition. I have also been very fortunate. I have a partner who has been exceptionally supportive of me. What do you think some of the nuances are for kids? I know you don't necessarily have kids, but you have enough friends who have kids. What do you see happening?
When I first started my transition, I was aware of an organization that was based in San Francisco called Collage, C-O-L-A-G-E. And it was specifically set up for children who had gay and lesbian and bisexual parents. And then they expanded into including children with trans parents. And so they put out some really good resources and support systems. And I started to notice that a lot of the LGBT centers, they would have support groups for these children who had gay and lesbian and bisexual parents, and they started expanding them, you know, to trans parents. And so actually, most of my friends don't have kids, so I don't have a lot of experience with this, and I don't work with children in my social work practice. But what I've noticed that can be the more successful outcomes, so to speak, with children is to include children in on what's happening at the level that's appropriate for them age-wise, right? But that's not anything different from, you don't burden your children with your financial difficulties, right? You don't involve your children in necessarily in some interpersonal dispute you're having at work, right? So I think there is a way in which, you know, we want to be able to do in an age-appropriate way, you know, bringing in information into the family, into the household, that's going to give them enough information that what they're seeing and what they're hearing, maybe people talking, or in the case, if it was somebody like me, you take testosterone, your voice starts to deepen. They understand, they're watching this unfold in front of them. And so, you know, I hear people say all the time, and I agree with this, that it's not just the trans person who's transitioning, right? It's everybody around them is transitioning, because everybody in the world, in the sphere, right, in the world of the trans person is going through a process as well. And so children are doing that too. And I think it's just a matter of getting them connected in with other kids who have the same experience as them, at letting them ask questions. That's always good, you know, letting them ask questions and not scolding them for asking questions, like not using the type of, you know, adult politically correct language that we would expect of somebody in a peer group, that children are going to say, you know, as well, I'm not going to mention names, but children say the darndest things, don't they?
They do. I have three sons, and my oldest is fairly accepting, but my youngest refers to me as Moma Dad. Now, I express gender queer, so, you know, I don't necessarily get all worked up over the fact that my other two sons still continue to refer to me as Mom. In the context of sitting at a dinner table, which happened one year, my granddaughter was present, and she got very upset with my son because the server came up to me and hadn't caught on at all. And I was placing an order. And my son, for some reason, felt compelled to point to me and use female pronouns. My granddaughter sat across the table, flashing him very dirty looks. Once the server left, I knew all hell was going to break loose, and it did. And he sat there as she had called him out on his stuff. You know, I've had people challenge me, doesn't that get under your skin? Well, a little bit, I suppose, in that circumstance. But I can't force my kids to go through their journey faster. And that's always my message to others. I have to allow my children to adjust. And while I've been doing this for some time, this particular son works in the construction industry. So it's all about manhood and, you know, manning up. And he respects me, but he struggles. And he really is just about the only kid who struggles out of all three of my sons.
Well, I'm of the mindset, and I think this comes largely from just, you know, living life, right? And then add on top of it, doing psychotherapy and working with people who struggle with adjusting, right? Adjustment is a difficult thing for a lot of people. And going through different transitions in life, whether they be going from being an adolescent to a young adult, going from being gainfully employed to losing your job, from entering into a relationship, ending a relationship, like these transition periods in our life are struggles, right? And many times that's what leads us into psychotherapy, is when we're having difficulty adjusting to a transition. And so why would our transitions, right, gender transitions, be any different, not only for us, but for the people around us? And so that's one thing I like to remind people of. Another thing I like to remind people of is, because, you know, this comes up in my family from time to time. I have a couple of aunts, you know, three aunts, they're in their 80s. You know, they're wonderful Mexican ladies, right? They're grandmas, great grandmas at this point. And, you know, they call me the name that I was given by my parents when I was born. And I don't care. And people say to me the same thing, like, doesn't it bother you? Do you correct them? I do not. I never correct them. And part of the reason for that is that it's almost like it's not my business what they think about me, right? That's sort of an old saying. And if I know who I am, And I live in the world, how I live, right? If people could see me right now, it's like, you know, people call me balding, but it's, you know, it's just the crown of my head. I've got hair on my head, right? I've got a big, thick beard and mustache. You can hear my voice. You know, nobody thinks I'm a woman when I walk around or sound like one. And so it's good enough for me. And part of the issue for me is that I don't want my aunts or anybody for that matter turning it around on me and telling me that I'm not thinking correctly, I'm not speaking correctly, I'm not believing correctly, and I need to change my ways, right? Because if I'm out there correcting everybody and telling them what they're doing wrong, that gives them the liberty to do the same thing to me if they don't like how I'm talking about things. And so now there are times and places, of course, there are things we say we shouldn't be saying, but I'm talking about my aunts and anybody else that I interact with or don't even interact with, people who are just listening to this. They have their right to their thoughts and their feelings and their beliefs. And I have no interest whatsoever in changing that for them. Now, they might be listening to this or they might engage with me directly and they come to their own conclusions about, I'm going to think more intentionally about this. I'm going to do some reading, or I'm going to spend more time with people like Xander and On, and I'm going to see maybe what else there is out there. That's what I hope happens. I don't want to force people into changing their thoughts and their beliefs and their ideas.
And now we will take a commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Right, we are back from our commercial break. We left off talking about whether or not we correct people when they misgender us. Why don't you pick up where you left off, Xander?
It's not very popular, I've come to find. Let me rephrase. I do think it's popular and common. I think the way what we've been talking about is very much in the mainstream. However, it is not what a lot of people are exposed to, because what a lot of people get exposed to are not the mainstream. It's more the fringes. And so I think it's on the fringes, you know, the messages that come from the fringes, like maybe like activist messaging, is gonna contradict what we say, because they really do want to change how people think and feel and believe and act. Very directly so.
There is a lot of that occurring. And I think we, for years, have said we wish people understood us better. And yet people within our own trans community aren't very understanding and feel very threatened by some of our individualities and the way we think, feel, and basically interact with others about some of these very touchy subjects that are circulating. And I think that can be, you know, that can be a really tough landscape to navigate for a lot of trans people who may not fit this idealistic way of thinking, which is, you will use my pronouns, you will recognize me immediately as who I am, And I, for one, I mean, you can look at me. I, for one, get misgendered all the time. And part of that is my voice, but part of it is also because I am a bit genderqueer and I like who I am and I'm okay with that. But for other people, that could be very, very threatening. Some years ago, I had a trans female tell me that she felt very strongly that there weren't necessarily true trans people unless they were transsexuals. And that was an interesting conversation because part of me felt there are variances in our world. And we always talk about our brains connecting with that identity of male or female, but we make it sound very binary. And for many people who are, quote, transsexual, they've been through the surgeries, they've done their reassignments, that is probably very true. But then there are other people where that may not be the case. And so there's also this nuance circulating within our community where people feel threatened by the fact that they can't be identified as trans. So we do come from all walks of life, including Two-Spirit, right? Two-Spirit is another such example of Native Americans. And even around the world, they have these individuals who are in these tribal communities, have for centuries never taken on male versus female, and are very fluid in their identities.
Maybe they do take on more what's considered to be masculine or feminine, you know, sex role and sex, you know, presentation attributes, but they're still recognized as a third or fourth or fifth category of person within their culture. You know, this idea about we want people to understand us better. I think part of the issue here is that, well, first we have to understand ourselves better. And that's on an individual basis because there's no monolith in the trans community, not of experience, not of identity, not of trajectory of how we're going to do a transition, whether that's social, medical, legal, however we're going to do it. And so part of the stumbling block for me early on, you know, back several years ago, was how do I even talk about this experience? How do I talk about how I feel? How do I talk about what I want to do? How do I communicate to other people? Because I can use certain words, I can describe, I can explain, but that doesn't mean that on the other end, the listener comprehends what it is I'm talking about, what I mean, what I'm going to be doing. And so I think part of the issue is vocabulary, right? There's a lot of nuance and complexity around biological sex, gender identity, sex role, you know, cultural ideas about the sexes, the presentation, right? The feminine to masculine androgynous presentation. These things all are very, they're very complex. And so, you know, you mentioned genderqueer, you know, back in the day, I referred to myself as androgynous, right? When I was part of lesbian community, right? Androgynous. And, you know, once I entered into the trans world in 2000, then I was learning about, oh, there's transsexuals. And then there's transgender people. And now there's, you know, non-binary or gender non-conforming or gender diverse or polygender, right? There's so many other labels that people take on. And so, you know, when, you know, I was saying earlier about it's not my job or really anybody's job to change how people individually think or feel or what they say, but that doesn't mean that we can't work towards changing laws or policies that we find might obstruct our access to what it is we want access to. We have to then also be ready for the good possibility, and now I think it is very much a reality, that goes two ways. We can work towards changing laws in our favor, and people can work towards changing laws that are not in our favor. And so once we jump, you know, when we started out trying to advance, you know, awareness and education about this thing called transgender or transsexual, you know, before the word transgender was being used, we were doing it in the families, in our communities, maybe a little bit into the workplace, you know, and maybe the places that we worship and we started building, maybe in the university settings. And then we started trying to pass laws at the state level and then at the federal level. And so I don't know that people understand us better these days, but they sure know we're around. We've definitely made ourselves more visible. And with visibility comes vulnerability. So it's a trade-off. The more visible we are, the more vulnerable we are at that interpersonal and at the, you know, at the larger level within our communities. And so I think, you know, as a clinician, where I go to when I think about that heightened level of vulnerability is, okay, how then can we strengthen the resilience of people in our community? How can we enhance, what tools and strategies can we share with members of our community to help them become more emotionally and mentally and socially fit? Right? That's what I do. And that's the kind of practice I have now as I focus on that particular area. You know, how can we learn to regulate our emotions? How can we learn to tolerate distress? How about managing our stress, mitigating conflict, communicating more effectively, having empathy and compassion, right, for ourselves and other people? I make mistakes, therefore I must then be compassionate towards those who make mistakes. By mistake, I don't mean punching me in the face or, you know what I mean? I mean truly mistakes, like using a name or a pronoun that is not what I would prefer, what I want used. But that's not the same as pointing a gun at my head. But we've escalated language to where if somebody, quote, misgenders me or, quote, dead names me, I don't use that kind of language. But when people, I hear people saying now, when somebody, quote, dead names me, they feel that they've had violence perpetrated against them. It's like, well, that's not violence. Those are words, you know, and maybe sticks and stones don't break my bones, but names will, you know, maybe that little, you know, childish song doesn't work anymore, but we have to find a way to be able to let people do and say what they do and say and, you know, rise above it, tap into our own well-being, our own resilience to be able to withstand when somebody does or says something we don't like. Because I don't know about you, On, and your listeners, but that happens to me all the time. That's just life. People do and say things I don't like all the time. I'm not in control of that. I'm only in control of how I react or respond to it. That's all I have control over.
I agree. I think we are at a stage in life where people are ready to just strike out for any reason. And it's tough because there doesn't seem to be the same level of resilience anymore. And I'm not talking about resilience in kids necessarily. I'm seeing it in, you know, lacking in adults. This inability to navigate their emotional reactions. And, you know, I have these discussions when my partner and I are talking about what we are witnessing. And, you know, we always say, yeah, you know, count to 10, deep breaths. Something I try to teach my grandchildren all the time, try to take some deep breaths, count to 10. That oxygen will do your brain a lot of good and it will drop your cortisol levels and you'll feel calm and you'll actually be able to think. It is like encountering a brain storm that results in some very unpleasant outcomes.
I mean, it's very common for people to feel hijacked by their emotions because emotions just come on suddenly. And if they don't have, you know, a toolkit of resources, of strategies and tools, like taking deep breaths, like taking a walk, like listening to some calming music, then they're going to react to whatever's in front of them. They're not going to give themselves time to calm and then respond to it. And so, you know, I was listening to a psychologist talk recently on a podcast, and she works primarily with trans teens, and people who have borderline personality disorder. Now, teenagers are not diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, because a lot of the traits of a personality disorders are just common everyday teenage behaviors, right? So they don't do that if it persists beyond adolescence. But she was talking about how some of the ways in which people who have borderline personality disorder, the way that they frame their experience, their life, she feels like what's happening now is there might be some cultivation of borderline traits that the teenagers are picking up on, right? And it's syncing up with their own sort of natural tendency towards, you know, very black or white thinking, right? And you're for us, against us kind of thinking, right? They're not in the gray, they're not in the nuance, they're not in context. And so she gave an example, right? And the example she gave is in the what's called gender-affirming therapy model, right? Not necessarily as described in the book, the textbook about this, but in the way it might be practiced by some people out in the world. You know, a teenager comes to you, they say, you know, oh, I'm questioning, I'm struggling, I want to, you know, look into my gender. And then somebody, quote unquote, affirms them, right? You know, oh, you're trans. Right? What you're describing is transgender. You're transgender. And then the kid says, well, I don't think my parents are going to accept this. And then you get the therapist to try and collude with this child, right? With this teenager against the parent, right? So you're basically setting up in the child's mind, in this teenager's mind, that their parent is the enemy. Their parent doesn't love them. Their parent doesn't accept them. Their parent rejects them. Ultimately, their parent is no more than a bigot that wants to erase or eliminate them, right? That's the kind of language. And so we're going to keep secrets from parents. We're going to, I'm going to tell the parent that if they don't let their kids socially or medically transition, you know, they're a much higher risk for suicide, right? To kill themselves. And so that, to me, that's emotional blackmail, right? And so what we're doing is we're the idea she's talking about is that we're, and I'm adding into this, this is not exactly what she said, but I'm adding in some of my own thoughts, which are that if we teach young people that their parents are bigots and that they need to withhold information from their parents, then we're going to rupture the relationship between that child and that parent. And why would we ever want to do that? Why would we want to inflict an attachment disorder into the life of this young person? And I really wish people would stop and find a way to engage in a therapeutic alliance with these young people that was more in alignment with ethical codes that would allow for, you know, affirming that the child has doubts, questions, concerns. Absolutely. Who doesn't have all those things, right? I don't think I've ever been to therapy and somebody telling me like, no, you don't have those thoughts and those concerns and those doubts. Like that would be ludicrous, right? So we can affirm those things. And we might even be able to affirm, like, you know, you're struggling with your gender right now. You have questions about your gender and what's expected of you and how you want to present differently and you want people to see you differently. That's a common exploratory process that you do when you're dealing with identity, you know, construction issues. And so the problem is, though, that wanting to look at this from a either or, you either affirm or you're a conversion therapist, you know, you're doing reparative therapy if you don't absolutely affirm. It's like, well, they're missing out on the bulk of what, you know, psychotherapeutic intervention is meant to do, which is to give people the time and space to really wrestle and discern with what's going on with them, what they're experiencing, what they're thinking, what they're feeling. And the concerns that they might have, the anxieties they might have about how other people are going to respond to that, including their parents.
You know, my grandson went through a period where he liked glitz and glitter. And he was a lot of fun and he was just adorable. And my partner and I were kind of wandering. And I was talking to my daughter-in-law one day and he's in the background and she got on him about something. He was doing something. I don't know what it was. And he turned around and he said, I want to be a girl. And I didn't say anything. And then she says to me, he's saying that because he knows it gets to me. I said, oh, okay. So I just segue into the conversation that we were having. This grandson of mine goes to a school where it's predominantly out in the country. And he was taken under the wings of this, who I called an angel bus driver, who also drove his sister. And she had been around for years and basically knows the two of them. But she took him under her wings because he was teased a lot, because he tended to be at that time presenting with very long hair. And we would talk about that. And I would say to him, you know, you have two Native American tribes in your bloodline, you know, coming from both mom and dad. Be proud of that. And just look at kids and just say, hey, I happen to have Native American in me and I like my hair long. And he to this day, he still misses it from time to time. He's segue into now pumping iron and he's interested in girls. But it was really interesting because at one point, all I could focus on was his safety. His parents were concerned because he was coming off the school bus with a black eye. Things were happening. And they decided that they were not going to even explore that part of his agenda. And they were going to let the chips fall where they may fall. I wasn't about to rock that boat. It wasn't my place. I wasn't receiving him on a daily basis. And I think we do have to be mindful of where people are in the world and what they experience. And is it safe? Is it safe? That's another big issue.
We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are talking about teens struggling with their identity, or maybe they announce they are one of the genders that we've been talking about. So we will pick up where we left off. Xander, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Well, it's like, you know, if those parents, right, brought that kid in to see me, right, if I did psychotherapy with children, you know, I'd want to know some things, you know, about the kid. You know, I would ask the kid, you know, in that age appropriate way, like, oh, you want to be a girl? You know, what is it about being a girl that you like? You know, because it's possible that he was being teased, right? He was being teased. He was being bullied because, you know, he had long hair like a girl. And so, you know, what you did is you gave him the counterbalance to that, which is, you know, in a very culturally specific way, that long hair in males is a given. But there's also the sense in which people could have brought in religious references, like Jesus had long hair, or they could bring in pictures of, you know, the sexy guy Fabio on all the, you know, the front covers of the books. Like, he's got long hair and the women love him, right? I mean, that's not appropriate maybe for a little kid. But it's like, I think a lot, you know, I said earlier something about sex role. And I think a lot of what's happening nowadays is you have children who are expressing an interest in play and clothing and activities that are associated with the other sex, so to speak, right? And instead of people saying, oh, well, there are lots of girls who want to be doctors, or there are lots of boys who do dancing, or girls have short hair. Let me show you some pictures of some very famous women with short hair. Or I think that's how it used to be. That's what was done when I was growing up. I don't think we're doing that as much anymore. I think we're saying, oh, if those parents took that kid to a different kind of therapist and the kid said, I want to be a girl, I think they would try and pressure the parents into letting them socially transition. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't say you need to discipline the kid or you need to. No, I would do more kind of what you did, which is, let's see, why are they saying they want to be a girl? Is it because they're looking around and noticing that girls get treated better in the school? Is it because the way the daughter is being treated in the home is better than the way the son is being treated in the home? You never know. You have no idea that in what's happening in those little minds of theirs about how they're making sense of all this. And the only way to know is to just ask instead of, quote, affirm and say, that's right, you are a girl. That's exactly what people are lobbying for us to do. And if we don't do that, as clinicians speaking specifically, we could lose our license in some places, right? And in some states, they're basically talking about they're going to take the kids away from the parents, regardless of which direction they go in. One state, it's if you don't affirm immediately, and in other states, if you affirm at all. it's like it's things are getting very extreme, very polarized on this issue. And it's as simple as that. Why does the boy say, I want to be a girl? That's easy to figure out.
A bill that was introduced into California to welcome people from other states. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I don't know what the name or the number of the bill is, but it's similar to when they say, if you live in this state or this county, we're not going to let the immigration naturalization people come in and get you. So I think it's like creating, I forget what those are called, right? It's like California has made itself a state that says, and so now there are instances where one parent has taken the child from another state over into California against the wishes of the other parent who has custodial care, but they may be a divorced couple, right? But the arrangements, the legal arrangements between those two parents is that they both have say in the child's health care. But the California, my understanding is that California is saying it doesn't really matter what the legal document says. If you bring your kid to California, we're gonna help you out with getting access to different medical treatments or legal processes.
I wonder what the backlash will be of that in time to come.
Well, we'll see it. You know, what we'll see is probably one parent in one state bringing a lawsuit against the parent in the other state. And I don't know how that works. Is it like, you know, Texas is going to sue California, or is it the dad in Texas suing the mom in California? And can you even do that, right? Can you require people from California to show up in Texas for a court hearing? Like, I don't have enough knowledge about how those kinds of legal proceedings play out, but I think we're going to start seeing it because there are already legal battles going on. And as of January 1st is when that law in California, I believe, went into effect. So there have been parents who have taken their children now from their state of residence and over into California. When you do therapy with a child and you have divorced parents, regardless of which parent is bringing the child into therapy, you still have to talk to the other parent. Right. You still have to make sure that they agree, especially it depends on what is in the custody arrangement. If it's 50-50, you need that other person. Right. You need a release of information. You want to get collateral information from them. So oftentimes one parent says, oh, I want my kid to be in therapy. If the other parent doesn't agree to it, oftentimes it doesn't happen.
Xander, when I was talking with you earlier about Governor DeSantis' bill for parents, you corrected me, and I'm appreciative that you did that. Tell me once again what your understanding of that bill is.
Sure. Thanks for prefacing it as my understanding, because again, I'm not an expert in law and government processes for creating bills. But my understanding is that this bill, and I don't know the name or number of it, maybe if you get that, you could put it in the show notes for the listeners. So it's oftentimes referred to as the Don't Say Gay Bill. And it is specifically concerning kindergarten through third grade, public school, teachers, and what they can and cannot introduce into their lesson plans in those grades. Anything above third grade is supposed to be age appropriate. So I don't know how that's being handled. But in kindergarten through third grade, the idea is, and this is the example you gave me, you know, if there's a student in one of the classrooms and they happen to have a parent that's transgender, the law doesn't prohibit that student from talking about their transgender parent. It doesn't even prohibit the teacher from acknowledging that that student has a transgender parent. What it's talking about is that the teacher in the public school system, meaning as a government agent, right, who doesn't have freedom of speech in the classroom because they are an agent of the government when they're a teacher in the public school, that they are to follow the curriculum that is approved by the school board and the superintendent and whomever else is involved. It's different in different places. And so there won't be any specific lesson plans where children are to be taught, this is what gay is, this is what lesbian is, this is what these things, these are considered maybe above that age range as far as the ability to comprehend what people are even talking about around issues of sexual orientation. But so it's not that the word gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender or anything like that can never be uttered in a classroom in the state of Florida. It's very specifically narrowed to K through three. And it's just that they don't want, you know, the example I gave you was in a lot of schools around the country, people are introducing something called the gender-bred person or the gender unicorn, right? So these are very playful little cartoonish diagrams that show this is sex and this is gender and this is gender identity and this is gender expression and this is sexual orientation. It shows everything. It has little arrows or things pointing to the unicorn or the gender-bred cookie, so to speak. And they're basically saying like, that's a teaching lesson. And that doesn't need to be in K through third grade. If you want to bring it into fourth grade, fifth grade, whatever is age appropriate, but not K through three. They're like, just focus on the basics of teaching that have to do with how to read, how to write, right? How to get along with other people in the classroom and on the playground. Just stick with the fundamentals. And I don't disagree with that.
I found the bill, Sander. It's okay. Florida's HB 1557. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, what a lot of people probably don't know is that there was widespread approval by parents for this bill across all political spectrums, right? Democrat, Republican, Independent. And as a matter of fact, I mean, you know, Governor DeSantis recently ran for re-election and it was a landslide. So, you know, it's controversial, of course. And I think a lot of organizations wanted to make a big splash about it by referring to it as a Don't Say Gay bill. I've said this with other things on other podcasts, and that is that a lot of these large LGBT nonprofit organizations, they get grants from philanthropic organizations, from government agencies, but they also get donor dollars. And it seems to me that the more angry and scared you can make people feel, the more likely it is that they're going to donate money, right? I know that's quite pessimistic of me, and I don't tend to run pessimistic, but I do believe that the amount of fear and the amount of the escalation of language from you don't see us to you're racing us to you're trying to eliminate us to there's a genocide occurring. That kind of language to me is appalling, considering that true genocides exist in our world and that many peoples who live on the planet today have lived through genocides and their family members have lived through genocides. And I don't think we should use that word so casually, that maybe you're having the experience that people don't see you how you want to be seen. They're not treating you how you want to be treated. They're not using the words you want them to use. I know that that is distressful, but that's not genocide and it's not violence. If there's true violence happening, then it needs to be reported, right? You know, I'm all for advocacy work. I'm all for activism. I just think that we need to stay within the bounds of reality. And there is no genocide occurring in the United States for trans people.
I really appreciate your outspokenness, Sander. It's important.
It's, you know, there's many of us speaking, but those of us speaking in the way that I'm speaking are in the minority of those speaking, but we're not in the minority of those who think and feel the way we do. But many more people are afraid of the backlash that comes when you speak. It's like we're told that trans people are living authentic lives and that our lived experience should be what people listen to. Well, I'm a trans person. I'm living authentically, and this is my lived experience. And through my lived experience, these are the ideas that I have come to. These are the beliefs that I've come to. And I share those with many, many other people. And they might not be in alignment with what other trans people have experienced, what other trans people believe, and what other trans people want other people to think about them or the community, so to speak, as a whole. But you know, we don't have control over that. You know, what might be better is if more trans people got together and could be in the same room with each other, because we have similar goals, right? I want to be able to go to the doctor and not get hassled. I went to go see a doctor recently. She didn't know I was trans. She was a brand new physician to me. She didn't read in my chart that I had gender dysphoria diagnosis. That I was on testosterone. And so when I questioned her about the communication she was having with me about how my prostate was healthy, I kind of looked at her and I said, oh, you didn't read my records. Like, I'm trans. And she said, don't insult me. And I said, my intention wasn't to insult you. My intention was to let you know, like, I'm trans. I don't have a prostate. And she got so angry at me, she got up from her chair, went out of the office, and called the police and had the police come to the clinic to protect her from my hostility. That happened to me a month ago.
Oh, that's terrible, Xander.
Right? We don't want that to happen to anybody. I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want it to happen to you. I don't want it to happen to any trans person, whether they're binary or non-binary. I don't care. I don't think, right? So we can come to agreement on that. We don't want to be, you know, have the police called on us when we go to a clinic to get our hormones refilled.
What was the outcome of that?
The police came and they took me into a separate office and they asked me from my perspective what I thought was happening. And they agreed with me that the doctor was a bit reactionary. And then the next thing I did was, this is the Department of Veterans Affairs, by the way, so it's the VA in Orlando, Florida. What I did is I contacted our LGBTQ veteran care coordinator for our healthcare system to alert her to what happened to me with this doctor, this medical doctor. And I was informed that I'm not the first trans patient to have an interaction like I had with this physician. So that then lets them know that they need to have another conversation with that physician supervisor. So I feel good about that because I feel like there's some remediation there. There'll be somebody's going to have a talk with somebody. Hopefully that person will be required to go through maybe the in-house VA training that when I was a VA social worker, I was part of designing that training, at least the previous one. It might be a new one now that lets people know like the right way and the wrong way to interact with trans veteran patients.
Yeah, we have a lot of work yet to do.
We have a lot of agreement. We don't want to be treated badly by doctors. So let's work on that together rather than all this fighting and bickering and name calling and trying to get people to, you know, lose their job and doxing people. I think that all needs to stop.
Xander, we've come to the end of our hour. I want to thank you for your time. And again, once again, your openness. And I do appreciate the fact that we were able to cover so much territory. I mean, just think about it, what we just covered today. How eye-opening for our audience. But before you go, I want you to talk about dead naming, because I don't think everyone in our audience understands what dead naming is.
Sure, of course. So this concept of dead naming is that, you know, for example, there's a name that my parents gave me when I was born. And so the idea is that if somebody calls me that name, that is my, quote, dead name, right? I do not use this language. This is not a concept that I endorse. But the idea is that that name, and I guess me as a child, is dead. That's the only way I can make sense of it. And so they'll say, if a person refers to me by my, quote, birth name, that's the name I say, the name I was given at birth, that they're dead naming me. Again, it's a concept that I don't abide by, and I don't agree with at all. But you may hear it either in passing or in reading or even used directly at you if you're doing it. My question to people who use the word dead naming is, when did you die? And why did you need to die to be who you are? Most people conceptualize their transition as becoming who they are. So if we're becoming who we are, right, and there's more than one conception, but let's just use that one. If I'm becoming who I am, I didn't die. What part of me died? That's what I don't understand, the usage of the term dead naming.
Yeah, I've never used it myself.
Yeah.
All right, Xander, I hope someday soon you'll return and we'll have some more really cool conversations. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation. Really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. We're at the end of the Umbrella Hour. Please join me next week.